Tonight I'm going to do a second talk, offer a second talk on this first picture of the ox herding pictures. And again, the phrase of the verse is, in the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. And bringing forth that image of the figure walking through the forest, looking behind him, feet going one way, lost in these maze of paths. So for those who might be joining us new, we're using these Zen teachings of the ox herding pictures as a way to inform and understand our own practice as insight practitioners, as Vipassana practitioners, because it's a very beautiful laid out map of the spiritual process, the pathway toward awakening. And it has some very beautiful ways of teaching some subtlety of how our paths often, are the way we start the path often has to transform. And tonight, I'm really drawn to talk about, in some ways, two opposite things. They're in some ways contrary to each other. The deepest aspiration of us as practitioners versus the skillful means we work in learning to work with our minds, working with our hearts. Another way to say this is the absolute and the relative. The absolute reality, the relative reality. Absolute path and the relative path. So last week, 2 weeks ago, I talked about this picture kind of brings forth this fruitless search for happiness that we so often find ourselves in. We search for happiness in this situation, in this role, in this possession, in this relationship. And yet all of those are ultimately impermanent. They all ultimately are arising and passing away. And so at some point we start to realize that we're looking for happiness in a sustained happiness in something that's always impermanent, always changing. So tonight I want to balance that perspective, that talk, with them, how can we work with relative happiness? How can we work with relative joys of life, and hold them in balance, as well as working and understanding this absolute perspective that these pictures really draw us toward. So there's this, often we have this confusion as practitioners between the relative and absolute. We confuse one for the other. And, we think we want one, we want the relative, and we actually are looking with absolute or vice versa. And this causes quite a bit of struggle and suffering in our lives as spiritual practitioners. Because these pictures really point toward the absolute. So just to have that as an understanding. But sometimes what's really needed in our practice, in our life, is the relative. Is how do we meet that in a relatively skillful way in a relative reality? So this, I probably shouldn't unpack and talk about what I mean by relative versus absolute. So relative is our normal way of perceiving the world, of being in the world. This is how we go about our daily business, our relationships, our jobs, our families. We know how to navigate it. And certainly for some of us, the relative reality is very charged, very difficult. The cards are stacked against us. Sometimes we have a certain amount of ease or privilege in our lives. This is our condition of how society holds us in the greater scheme of things. Whether, like, for example, we're white or black, that's a big difference in that relative reality. Absolute is talking about this way that transcends all differences, all sense of separation. And this is kind of the deepest pointing of the Buddha's teaching and often articulated very strongly in the Zen tradition. And so they sometimes often seem contradictory or in opposition. But as these pictures, if you reflect on all 10 of them, there's this beautiful way of going from the relative to the absolute and then joining those back together into that last picture, that last image of entering the marketplace. And so just kind of holding that bigger perspective. Because the tricky thing is that sometimes what seems to be the absolute perspective, the absolute, using the absolute reality, That's what we're beginning with. It actually, we realize that is actually relative all along. We don't realize how much that sneaks in. Simple example is, let's say we read about enlightenment and awakening, and we're like, okay, that's really what I want. I want to really want to get that. I want to get that on my bucket list. You know, check that off. You know, I want to have a house. I want to have a spouse. I want to have children. And I want to be enlightened. Okay, then I get all that done. Right, and we don't realize that the relative is actually snuck in there. The sense of me being enlightened actually doesn't even make sense in an ultimate way. We start to realize that that sense of I doesn't carry through in the way that we understand it to be into awakening. Suzuki Roshi said that, strictly speaking, there's no such thing as an enlightened person, only enlightened actions. This enlightened expression of the heart, not this identity that this is what I am or who I am. When we start to go into that, we've shifted into the relative. We become more fixed. So on the other hand, you know, sometimes we can get stuck in the relative, that we're really always in the weeds, always dealing with our difficulty, our painful thoughts, our painful emotions. How do we fight this? How do we overcome things? We can do that when it shows up in our practice, the habit of seeing problems, of trying to struggle to overcome, and in our lives. You know, and so sometimes we actually, what seems to be a relative problem, actually that needs a relative solution, we actually realize as our practice deepens, as we start to see more clearly, it's actually a question of the absolute. And this is what the homework points toward. So you may wonder what all this has to do with the ox herding picture, this first one. And if we come into, if we focus just on the absolute, we risk spiritual bypassing. We avoid our unfinished business. We will avoid what's unresolved in our hearts in order to get over ourselves into that, chasing that ox, chasing that sense of awakening. And so this teaching, really looking at the relative and absolute and how we get kind of caught in one versus the other, is really embedded in these 10 pictures. It's embedded in a very, in some ways a subtle way, but also in a very deep way. As we reflect on them, they start to work on us. We start to see that how these what's so important in one stage of these pictures becomes completely unimportant in a different stage. And that's as our relative and absolute understandings start to change. So let's go a little bit more into this relative reality to kind of bring that balance in, because I want to make sure we don't ignore, you know, what needs to be addressed in our lives. Because you know, many of us have very significant suffering, difficulty that we're tackling, that we're trying to navigate through. And the absolute teachings, as often represented by these ox herding pictures, isn't always the right teaching for us at a particular time in our lives or a time in a particular situation. Because these pictures really are focusing on awakening. And sometimes what's more important is learning to work with our grief, with our anxiety, with the difficulties of mind. Because a relative suffering often needs a relative solution. You know, we often need to find that skillful way of meeting that. Physical pain. You know, simple example. I mean, how many of you who've been on retreat with me and you want to sit on the floor, and this is a wonderful posture, but sometimes our bodies don't accommodate very well to it. And we're struggling and struggling because there's this assumption that sitting on the floor is more sacred. Somehow it makes us more holy. You're the meditator if you're sitting on the floor. And if I can talk you into going to a chair, often you say, wow, suddenly that pressure, that struggle falls away. And there's this ease that comes from that. So the relative pain, we're trying to overcome it by trying to use a relative absolute solution. An example, I heard a practitioner was on a long retreat, a multi-week retreat, and developed an ulcer. But didn't know it was an ulcer, just thought it was this kind of persistent burning pain. in their abdomen, and they just, instructions were just feel it, just keep feeling the burning. So she felt it burning, burning, burning for a week or so, until finally they did something different, realized she had an ulcer that needed to be treated. And so this is so easy for us to, in this way, misuse our practice, to use the Dharma as a way to try to overcome something that really needs a practical, simple, direct approach. Of course, emotionalize. We live in a day and age when there's so much growing emotional intelligence and understanding and emotional health. It seems like for many generations, there's an increased health going on. Of course, not always the case. Not always the case, unfortunately. But we do have access to so many ways, really practical ways of working with our emotional difficulties, our wounding, the ways we've learned to distort our worlds based on how we were raised, how we experienced the world. So learning to find that emotional health is so important. Learning to have a healthy, friendly sense of self is so helpful, instead of trying to jump over that painful self, to learn to meet that with skill, with directness, with an ease. Relationships, how do we navigate those difficult things around our sexuality, around our boundaries, around our needs? How do we communicate? Many of the things we talked about last year, certainly trauma, when our nervous system, our system is just overwhelmed by something beyond what we can deal with, a traumatic experience, an event, an assault, or accumulation of small things that over time create our nervous system to be so charged. This too needs to be met in a skillful way, in a relative way that is really allows that trauma to start to discharge, to find balance. Grief, experiencing loss of loved ones, of even our own grief, is learning how to meet that in a healthy way, to acknowledge the whole landscape of grief. And so often it's painful. It's painful, and the practice can be a way to avoid that, to overcome that. Sometimes going into the heart of it, again, skillfully, with understanding, with guidance, is so helpful. So mindfulness, meditation, is very helpful in all of these things I mentioned, but often it's not the leader. And so we often need to have this skillful approach. Until things start to quiet down, we start to feel like, okay, the landscape of my mind, of my heart, even the circumstances of my life are starting to feel workable. You're starting to feel like I can meet this. And then the absolute understanding starts to come more forth. So just trying to emphasize that when we talk about these, like last week, talking really about this, what is really causing suffering in our lives, and understanding that it can just keep going. Sometimes we do really need a relative approach to it. And the same thing with happiness, that I spoke about how happiness we often are trying to find it in the relative. That's what we've always done in our lives. If I'm not happy, it's because of what I don't have. It's because of what I do have. It's because of who I'm with or who I'm not with, what I'm doing for work, what I'm not doing for work. We're often looking at those relativeness. So of course, there is a level that we need to get in balance. We need to find a way that we're relatively happy. There's also just the happiness of ordinary things we do as human beings, our hobbies, the things that, bring us enjoyment. So it's not about learning to somehow ignore those or letting go of all of those, but learning to release the clinging that goes around with them. So then when something's present with us, we can fully embrace it, fully enjoy it, without having that sense of stickiness. So an example, sometimes I go through one of my things I like to do is play online chess. And so sometimes, unfortunately, rarely, there's a sense of just pure enjoyment of like, oh, that was a beautiful combination. That was a beautiful way that was put together, that movement of pieces, whether I was doing better or worse in that, losing or winning in that. But so often it changes to this quality of clinging, like, okay, I've got to somehow win, and I keep playing and losing and losing. And that's where it shifted from this enjoyment to actually much suffering around it. I'm trying to find happiness in the midst of that activity. And yet, even in the midst, the pain, it becomes very uncomfortable because I know I'm just kind of gripped by the clinging mind, the obsessive mind. So something that can be source of happiness changes to a source of suffering. So relative happiness, you know, this is one of our delights of being human beings, the delight of seeing something beautiful like a flower, or hearing a bird song, having delight of a conversation with a person. And as our hearts start to mature, as it starts to become wiser, there's a sense of meeting those happy moments, those beautiful moments, those joyful moments, full-heartedly. And when they have passed, we let them go. We don't keep clinging to them. When they're present, we're fully present with them. And when they're absent, we're not yearning for it, not borrowing the anticipated pleasure of the future to enhance this moment, or borrowing the remembered pleasure to somehow enhance this moment. I once saw a Christmas card that said, if you anticipate Christmas for half the year and remember it for the other half, Christmas lasts all year. Right? And this kind of sums up that yearning for something, looking forward to it, while not really being present for what's here. Being on a retreat and yearning for the next retreat, right? And you learn to enjoy more and more what's right in front of you. And when it's no longer in front of you, there's a release of that. And correspondingly, that's how we meet the difficulty, how we meet the pain. We don't amplify it through our reactivity, through our resistance to it. We meet it, and when it's gone, then it's gone. So this is part of the maturity as this relative and absolute start to blend together. So there is definitely a relative happiness that we experience as human beings. As long as we're not confused about that being the absolute happiness, as long as we don't place all our hopes, our dreams on something that's ultimately impermanent, then there's no problem. There's no problem. So this is exploring the relative side of things. Now let's shift gears into the absolute. Okay, so the absolute understanding, absolute reality. This goes beyond what words can really adequately take us to. And yet this is what often brings us to practice, or really our hearts yearn for that understanding. Now this picture in particular, you know, the figure searching, not sure where to go, confused, struggling, you know, exhausted. In some ways, it represents a really open-eyed approach to our spiritual journey. You know, particularly around why are we practicing? Why are we actually doing all this investment of time, of energy? And is our practice going the right way? Is it actually leading to the aim that we're seeking? Now, sometimes I talk to students, or students share with me, that even after many, many years of practice under their belts, they're still not very clear about why they practice. It's one of my favorite questions when someone's struggling with doubt. It's like, well, why are you practicing? What's your aspiration? Because often it's kind of this vague sense. It's like, it's just a good thing to do. You know, it seems to help me in some way, which is true. We can practice without knowing why, and it can be very beneficial. And understanding right view and right intention brings a level of energy to it. By the way, Venerable Panawati is going to be speaking of this when she comes in about 18 days, I guess, in March 12th and 13th, I think. We'll talk more about that at the end here. But sense of like, why are we practicing, that doubt around it? That's actually a very wise question to bring forth. You know, why am I here? Because sometimes the way we were practicing, our attitude, you know, the techniques, there's so many variables, but the way we're practicing is a bit of a dead end. That we keep practicing and practicing and expecting something else to change. It's like, okay, you know, I just hope this will happen. And what's happening is we're often practicing in a way that's keeping the very root of our suffering intact. We're not really, our practice isn't directed toward understanding that root and resolving that root in a deep, profound way. It's like pulling dandelion weeds, you know, from our yard, that we just pluck the flowers instead of learning to go down into the deep taproot to find all the little small rootlets, the deep taproot and the little rootlets underneath. That's what the practice is designed to do. If it's really one that's uprooting suffering, the root of our suffering. And this picture depicts and really captures this fruitless search that we confine ourselves into, that we're searching this way and that way for this ox, for liberation, for our true self. We know that we're missing something. We're looking this way and that way, looking everywhere, but we're not sure where it is. Now, sometimes we have started practice and we had a very clear idea of why we're practicing. And sometimes we, in some ways, outgrow that. Our understanding starts to show that the very premise we started practicing doesn't actually make sense as our wisdom develops, as our understanding blossoms. Sometimes, you know, just we kind of forget it. It sort of fades into the backdrop. Sometimes life kind of gets, you know, the circumstances of our life becomes more prominent. You know, we have a job that's really engaging, or a new relationship, or we have children, or a health difficulty, and sometimes it just, the practice falls away. Sometimes those very circumstances, especially difficulty, we find our practice comes forth in a way that's, it's very strong, very, very grounded. It happens both ways. This last 2 years with the pandemic, you might just reflect, you know, how was it for you with your practice? I've heard from both, you know, both group of people, people who said that this last year, my practice just kind of fell away. I just didn't have any energy to practice. Or other people say, my practice is what saved me, is what got me through these days. So just noticing that for yourself, you know, where was the practice? Where did I go for refuge? So this kind of fruitless search. You know, last week I kind of said, okay, let's kind of stay there a little bit in that sense of not sure where to go, that confusion, because sometimes we want to jump ahead. But this picture tonight, I want to start to bring us into the next picture. We actually start to see the ox's trace, start to get traces of the ox, the footsteps. And another way to frame this question is like we're trying to remember, why do we practice? We're trying to clarify that in a very deep way. And in various multi-year programs that I've done, like through Spirit Rock, like the Dedicated Practitioners Program and my 4-year teacher training program, at different times they ask us to reflect on why do we practice? You know, why? What is our aspiration behind our practice? And inviting us to come to that from the deepest place. This is what the ox represents, not the superficial aspirations. You know, those are of use. They can often get us into practice, but allowing that deeper one to be clarified, to actually be known. And even not the idea of what, or the concept of what it means. You know, the idea of like, okay, enlightenment sounds nice. I want to put that on my bucket list. I want to check that off the box. You know, that in itself has that embedded perspective of the relative trying to understand the absolute. At some point, we come to terms with that. We see more clearly what actually the practice is about. So I'm talking about this deeper aspiration. It often becomes much more accessible when we take our normal sense of a horizontal time that we have, endless time. I mean, each one of us knows that we are not going to live forever, that our lives are finite. And yet we often live our lives like it is a forever thing. So bringing that quality of one way to access this question, what is the deepest aspiration for my practice, is reflecting on our mortality. and the beautiful words from Mary Oliver, When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body a line of courage, something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. When Death Comes by Mary Oliver. So when you start to really get a sense of this deepest aspiration, it often brings you really alive. It's not, I want to get there, I want to get to something outside of myself. You actually realize that right here, right now, is where I want to fully be. When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms, this full-hearted embrace. It's a different way of framing the spiritual practice, isn't it? Instead of becoming more sacred or more holy, instead of becoming someone special, it's learning to fully live your very ordinary life. Often in the suttas, the sense of urgency is pointed toward like practicing as if your hair was on fire. How would you practice if your hair is on fire? That level of intensity, like, okay, this is, nothing else matters except this. So this is the energy of these pictures. This is the energy of this early like 5 or 6 pages or pictures is really searching for that, trying to get a hold of where that ox is. And when we have that urgency, we start to look and look, search and search, as this first picture depicts, we start to drop more and more what doesn't work. We have this willingness and this clarity of mind to say, okay, this is just not going the way I want it to go. It's not leading to what I'm seeking. We drop those dead ends. We often don't put that question to it. You know, is this really going the right place? Is it really going where my wise view points me? So we often wander in a sense of vagueness in our practice and in our lives. Not really sure, you know, what I'm doing. Just like this picture depicts, we're going this way and that way. And we get, you know, get this energy to try to find it, but we're just going in circles. We're lost. So this picture and verse really point toward that vagueness, that lack of clear direction. And then yet, at the end, the very last phrase, we start to get a hint of a clarity after exhausting all the possibilities. That phrase that I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. And so suddenly there's something else coming. And this is what I love about how these pictures teach is that there's a kind of a coyote wisdom. To borrow the phrase from the Native American traditions of the trickster that teaches through trickery, teaches us our foibles, our blind ends, by letting us fail, letting us exhaust things. And I certainly know in my own practice, I've had exhausted many possibilities before the way becomes clearer. This process of elimination. And this is really the beginning of wisdom. This picture speaks to that wisdom of like, I've tried, I've searched every which way, and I cannot find the ox. All I hear is these locusts chirping through the forest at night. Okay, so this is really when we really try these different ways and really see some of them partially work or some of them almost work, you start to see that the way, actual way is different. In my own practice, my early days, I really was almost obsessed with this idea of resistance times experience equals suffering. So I was really trying to not resist this moment. I was trying to really relax into what was present. And it was amazing how much effort I was able to bring to the simple process of relaxing, how much struggle I brought into trying to relax, to trying not to struggle. You know, trying to, example was like trying to sit still, you know, being, I was in my 20s and feeling that, you know, okay, I need to sit still and sit cross-legged. You know, I was one of those people that sitting on the floor was more holy, more sacred. And so I'd sit through tremendous discomfort. My legs would just ache and there'd be this throbbing and I'd just try to breathe and relax. And there'd be all this light show as I would shift and release a little bit. But then as I started to notice that when the bell would call me back from a walking period, this was on a retreat, I would notice, oh, that bell, the next moment was a moment of fear, a moment of trepidation. And I realized I'm somehow conditioning myself to be afraid of meditation. And I started to look then, okay, my attitude of this kind of striving, this pushing, this sense of being stoic, all this was going contrary. I saw that through exhaustion, really, this path is not going the way. And so then I learned a deeper quality of ease, a deeper quality of relaxation. And throughout the years, you know, there's often a deeper and deeper understanding of what it really means to relax with the moment, what it means to really release the normal struggle and how subtle that struggle can be. At one point I realized I was starting a retreat and I was talking to my teacher, Rodney, and I just realized I didn't know how to practice because I saw that all of my normal ways of practicing had embedded in my normal strategies, my normal struggle, my normal sense of me trying to do something. And I just saw that all of that was not going anywhere. And so I had no idea how to practice because I didn't want to bring forth that normal strategy. And yet there was still there's that little chirping, the locust chirping. There was like, even though I didn't know, my rational mind didn't know what to do, my heart did. So this brings us into this sense of releasing our strategy, releasing our assumptions. This is in some ways the most difficult thing for us to do because we hold those very, very dear. This is how I organize myself in relationship to the world. So we often have to release what we thought was true and absolute. We don't realize that it was actually, we don't realize that we start this journey, what's really asked of us. It's asked of us what we must let go. Words of Rumi come to mind with this quietness. Inside this new love, die. Your way begins on the other side. Become the sky. Take an axe to the prison wall. Escape. Walk out. Like someone suddenly born into color. Do it now. You're covered with thick cloud. Slide out the side. Die and be quiet. Quietness is the surest sign that you've died. Your old life was a frantic running from silence. The speechless full moon comes out now. The speechless full moon comes out now. And the Sufi tradition, the Zen tradition, I mean, they just bring forth this absolute understanding, the absolute reality. And it takes us into the unknown. It takes us beyond our normal strategies, our normal ideas. And it's the paradox is that our surroundings are actually the same, and yet they're completely different. They're completely different. Something fundamental has shifted you, has shifted in you. So something that's so ordinary, that's always been present, just overlooked, ignored, suddenly is transformed to something that's beyond words. This is where this last picture takes us, this last verse of this picture. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. Everything else I've tried. And there's something drawing us into that absolute understanding. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. So before we go into some questions or some sharing around your experience, I'd like to just talk about the homework for this week in a way. Homework is an invitation for you to engage with this topic, this exploration in a very immediate way. So it's not something that we just hold as a passive relationship. It's actually, how does this show up in my life? And so I think I'll just share that chat again, hopefully. Yeah, still there. So homework. So searching for the ox, the relative and absolute. So I wanted to really phrase this and understand, remember what I said at the very beginning, that the relative and absolute, misunderstanding that, having a bias to one or the other, sets us up for suffering, sets us up for unnecessary struggle as practitioners. Yet, as these pictures depict, if you're like most humans, you're going to have to ignore that piece of advice and still set it up. So then you can have to learn through trial and error. So the next time you find yourself struggling, maybe you're seeking some type of happiness or some type of escape, just float this question. Is this a question of the relative or the absolute? Is this a question of the relative or the absolute? Is it the relative, like I need to change the circumstances, the way I'm practicing, the way I'm doing something, change, something that's concrete and practical? Or is it something that's really the shift of a profound perspective of the absolute, allowing that to come forth? Now hold whatever answer comes forth lightly, because we start to see that the relative is really an absolute, are kind of blurred together, that we start to see they both are present, they both are applicable. The relative has trouble holding the absolute, but the absolute, if it's really coming from that perspective, holds the relative effortlessly. So realizing, whatever the situation is, sometimes can seem it needs to be a relative solution, and you realize later on it has to be absolute, and vice versa. And then the other question, kind of the other part of this talk, was noticing or reflecting on what really the deepest reason for your practice is. What's the deepest reason? Allowing that to come forth. Maybe just contemplating, maybe your days are not limitless. What is that? How does that inform why you practice? And then reflect, does my practice lead that direction? Does it lead that direction? So often, this highlights little distortions of view, distortions of attitude, of kind of assumptions that are kind of buried down, embedded in the way we're practicing, that we don't realize actually maintain that deeper root of suffering, that deeper perspective. It keeps our normal way of normal assumptions intact. So there's a lot there in that homework, and hopefully you find a way to get some purchase on it, to engage with it. And next week we'll have some small group discussions and a recap of that. And I look forward to hearing how you worked with it. But for tonight, for us tonight, we have a chance now for any questions or comments or sharing you might have. And let me give you permission to unmute. All right. So if you'd like to raise your hand, you're welcome to do that. So raising your virtual hand is handy. You can do that usually by, I'm not sure actually where you can do it now. But Iris got it. So go ahead, Iris. Go ahead. What do you have to share and ask?
Thank you, Tim. Just thinking about the different ways that you spoke about the relative and the absolute, and what you said a moment ago, that the absolute holds the relative effortlessly, but vice versa is not true. And when we're stuck in the relative, you know, we can't even see the absolute. But you know, because the teachings talk about non-separation and non-duality and all. So, you know, in enjoying a pleasure like a beautiful sunset, I noticed very quickly that kind of like, oh, how beautiful. And as soon as I start holding on, the enjoyment goes away. And so, you know, it's maybe it's a relative thing, because maybe it's a conditioned response I have to the beauty of the sunset. And, you know, and if I notice the clinging, then I can sort of let go. And the initial, oh, isn't that beautiful, doesn't come back. But the tightness and the suffering goes away. So it's like, you know, the absolute's right there, you know, and then you said that several times in your talk, that it's not like there's a difference between this world and that world. It's how we relate to the world and our experience, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's all clearly said. Yeah, absolutely. That's good noticing too, that often we see something beautiful, like before sometimes it's so immense that we just, you know, it's like we're so carried away by that experience that our self is kind of like, wait, catch up. You know, it takes a while for that clinging engine to get going.
Yeah.
And the same thing with things which are very, you know, that we often say are sad or loss. But sometimes, you know, if you've ever been around, deep loss or seeing someone who's passed away, like right in that moment, sometimes there's just this openness that comes before the grief comes in, you know, and so that's another form of a clinging identification. Part of it is just the healthy human response to loss. So it's, you know, again, we don't want to discount the healthy way of working with things. But you're absolutely right. When we have that, you know, we can start to feel that you may, you know, a way to phrase what you're saying is, let's say you go back to the sunset. You know, when you find that beauty, and then when you start to notice that little subtle clinging, just say, okay, who is seeing this sunset? Mm-hmm. Or what is seeing this sunset? Because this is the kind of inside joke, is that the beauty that is resonating so much in the sunset is identical to the beauty inside of you. And when those come together, that's when that's like, it's so magical. And then we create that sense of separation, you know? And so it's that play of there's non-separation and separation. And so it's just to notice, okay, who or what is experiencing this? And just let that question, you know, see if there isn't some shared essence between the beauty of that sunset and the what is actually perceiving it.
Yeah, because there is something beautiful inside that beholds that. Yes. And, you know, and again and again and again, I see, you know, that whenever I'm around, things get tight.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you're seeing, you know, how suffering arises, you know, from that, you know, from really the technical definition is that selfing, that dependent origination. That's that whole process.
Yeah.
And here's something to consider is that any friction with the self arising is just more selfing.
Yeah.
And so ultimately there's just a love for that self arising. It's like, oh wow, this is what's arising.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's once that starts to come forth, it's just, there's an ease that starts to come into your practice and the ease in your life, which is profound. And, you know, we forget it, we get triggered, and then, but then, you know, once we have a taste of it, it starts to orient our practice. That's really the ox being sensed. That's what starts to pull us forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Iris. All right. Oops, sorry, I was lowering your hand, Iris. Sorry, when you were lowering it. There you go. What else is out there in your rooms, in your hearts, in your minds? If you're raising your physical hand, it's sometimes hard for me to see it. So the virtual hand is ideal if you can, but you can also just unmute. So Carly, go ahead.
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Yeah, I was thinking of this before Iris mentioned what she said, and I think they're really related, but I actually did the opposite of what I was advised, and I actually spent an entire day meditating yesterday, and meditated quite a bit this morning. And you know, and it does bring, you know, why am I practicing? And I think that is changing over time. But the one thing I noticed, though, and I it may have to do with I don't know if the suppression of selfing, but like the non-immediateness of selfing occurring. I mean, I just started seeing things spontaneously that were beautiful. And there's for me at least, there's something about practice that allows that to happen. It's kind of mysterious. Maybe if I thought about it, maybe it's not mysterious at all, but it feels mysterious. There's just something about practice that allows that. And and I guess, you know, Iris's comment around the sunset just reminded me of that. And I just thought I would share that kind of I don't know, not strangeness, but nice effect of practice. So,
yes, of seeing the ordinary beautiful, just seeing things how they, yeah, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, like this amazing cloud or, you know, slightly budding tree or something like that. Yeah. Just seeing it in a whole new way, I guess. And not trying to do it, it just happens. And
absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons, one of the effects of meditation is it really brings our attention together. It helps us release our thinking mind. It helps us really wake up our senses, wake up our perceptions. And so we become more and more present. And that's one of the rewards of that is that life often feels much more rich, much more vibrant. There's an aliveness that starts to come. And really, we're starting to become alive in ourselves instead of having this kind of veneer, this dullness of lost in thought and worry and all that stuff, fantasy. We're actually releasing that, so we actually see what's actually here. So meditation can do that. Sometimes, you know, big, you know, changes of environment, situations, things which are very, sometimes, you know, shocking, you know, disasters can cause that quality of aliveness to arise. And, you know, reflecting, you know, in that, you know, okay, that question, okay, why am I practicing? I think it's always helpful to say, you know, really start where we actually are. And it's like, well, you know, maybe there's just this longing to feel that quality of connection, of finding the beauty. And, you know, not to say, okay, that's not enough or that's not good enough. It's like, okay, that's really where my heart comes alive. And it's like, okay, that's why I'm practicing right now. Now, if that's alive for you, then that's beautiful. And, you know, our understanding changes and we start to see more and more, like I was talking with Iris. I mean, a big shift, and we see this in these pictures, is this shift of us observing, us experiencing something outside of ourselves, something beautiful, something, you know, that's heart touching, that there's just, we're breathless beauty, to start to realize that, as I said with Iris, is really reflected in ourselves. We start to see that is actually what we are. Also, you know, that same essence is like, it's like awareness is observing awareness, stillness observing stillness, nature observing stillness, nature. So it's a paradox. Again, there's that relative absolute. We start with relative perspective, but the absolute starts to come forth more and more. So not to get too muddled out there, but that's thank you for sharing that, Carlito.
Thank you.
And with practice, it's always good to just notice the, you know, cause and effect, you know, what's the effect of the practice. So, you know, suggesting not to practice as much, but you practiced a lot and that came alive. So that, you know, it's like you notice, you know, the effects of things. So that's like a beneficial day. So you trust more and more your own authority, your own understanding. All right, Judith, go ahead.
One thing I've been reflecting on a lot lately is the effect on my practice of getting old, right? Mm. Of aging and having, it's almost like I can picture it, this short future and this really long past, a lot of which I realize I don't even remember, you know? And it seems to me that the effect is to make it easier to be present somehow.
Yeah, that makes sense. That if we're really holding ourselves in our past history and our past experiences, by default, we're not as connected to what's present right now. So you probably that, I mean, sometimes I reflect like, you know, I spent 4 years in college and I remember like just a handful of things, but there's a whole lot of moments that just, what happened to those moments? But, and that's a nice reflection that means that instead you're right here, you know, you're able to be right here.
Yeah. And I've been, I get particularly aware of it when I talk to my sister, because we share a past and she remembers things that I don't remember, or I get an email from an ex-husband who remembers more about my past than I do. Mm-hmm. And I think, wow, what is it? Was it real? You know? Mm-hmm. And no, I guess it wasn't in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there's been studies that memory is very, you know, fluid. There's different ways the same person, two people can experience the same event, have very different experiences with it. And it's, you know, sometimes it's really helpful to reflect on that and it helps enrich our lives. And sometimes it just, you know, it's just already water under the bridge. And yeah. Another part of your comment was that, you know, there's a lot less futures than there used to be.
Right.
You know, like with my age, I'm in my mid 50s and it seems like I have a lot more time, but I actually have a lot less time than I ever did. Right. Whether I live, you know, another year or another 30 years, it's like, you don't know.
No.
But it becomes more and more obvious that, well, there's a lot less there. So that brings you back in the there's, you can't think, you know, there's more future. It's like, okay, we're really here. So they both those forces, that's really a nice exploration of how they come together.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And just on the subject of aging and practice, we're going to probably have a KM group come up that's going to be focused on, you know, aging and the Dharma, understanding how we, you know, both how do we navigate all the difficulties of our, you know, our bodies and our minds and, you know, our mortality and our friends passing away, all that. But also what you just spoke about, how there's also tremendous benefit of being an elder in our practice. So just, you know, keep your ears out for that. That will hopefully come down the pipe here in a little bit. All right. Who else would like to share anything, if anyone's like to? All right, Emery.
Good evening, and thank you so much for this talk. I just, it's been so beautiful to listen to and to listen to Iris's and Carlito's and Judith's questions that just deepen the conversation so much. And I love how you almost every time you give a Dharma talk, you weave in that that universal, you know, that or that absolute reality. And you know, it, and even though it's hard to put it into words, the words that you use help me just sense it more and more. But when Iris was talking about this, the sunset, what came up for me, like I totally related to that and related to the whole conversation. But then I was like, but then what about when you have to turn around and go deal with really challenging things? 'Cause, you know, like I really resonated with Iris's, the beauty within, seeing the beauty without and experiencing that. And then it's like, oh, now I have to go make my kid get off their Xbox, which is going to be like a nightmare, or, you know, go do another load of laundry or whatever it is. And trying to integrate that beauty, seeing beauty into daily life. And the way I experience it is very painful. I experience it as like a lot of longing for that sunset. And I just want to sit in front of that sunset for months. So any wisdom you have around that would be helpful.
Sure. Yeah. So that's, and that's part of the reason I talked about the relative and absolute, and, you know, realizing that sometimes we do really need that practical piece there. And yet, you know, our practice does start to bring that absolute into all the relative qualities or things we have to do in our lives. So, you know, you kind of set up a very kind of clear image there of, you know, there's the beauty of sunset, and the sunset's not asking anything of you, right? It's not asking you to tell it it looks beautiful, or to, you know, even take a picture of it, or, you know, just there, just doing its thing, and you have no responsibility. So that's part of what happens. Then contrasting that with your child and the Xbox, and, you know, all the parental responsibilities, and the, you know, his pushing against the authority, and that, you know, that's part of his task, is to have some, to do something that, to push against. And, you know, and there's this weird dance that we have to do to become healthy human beings, is learn to push and pull and find our way through that, you know, recover our independence and yet our connection, you know, is that constantly pulling back and forth. And what if that in itself was also just part of this whole play? You know, but this time you have to act, you have to be with it, you have to do something with it. So you start to just hold that as a possibility. And, you know, maybe you may be starting with something that's, you know, back to the nature not asking anything of you. But notice something which is less beautiful in nature. You know, maybe a dead crow or a roadkill or something that's that, you know, that's a little bit hard to see or to perceive. And see if that too actually could have a certain level of stillness, a level of engagement around it. So, because the beauty, you know, like that, it self-reinforces, we can relax into it. But even the horrific things, you know, maybe not, don't go too horrific, just, you know, mildly, you know, unpleasing kind of a thing to practice. Seeing if, okay, how can I relate to that? And then with your son, seeing that too, that, okay, you know, here there's a sense of pushing away, a sense of pushing against, there's a sense of trying to control. Once if this is just kind of the tug of war of life, of the current, you know, it's like you just want the tide to come in or do you want to come in and out? You know, there's that back and forthness to it. And so then see if that starts to loosen up something. So you kind of start to see, one teacher talked about his, one of his books or his talks was, you know, emptiness dancing, that sense of emptiness dancing with life, you know. And so we start to learn to find that sense of fluidity to it. And it's much more challenging. You know, it's definitely more, much more challenging. And yet, because it's more challenging, there can be a deeper integration with it. So similar to Iris, what I posed with Iris is noticing, you know, who is observing, who is sensing, who is seeing this sunset, who is talking to my son about, he's been on the Xbox for 5 hours now and he's got homework to do. You know, who is that? And that, from that question, you know, if you really ask it sincerely, you see there's a part of you that there's the controlling mom, there's the mom who's concerned, there's the mom who feels like she's not doing a good enough job. And there's also some other element that's right there too. And so you start to see all of that. And then you might find that there's a more of a fluidity, if there's more of options, there's more. It can be kind of strange that actually the very way you ask and the very relate to your son starts to change when you start to bring that forth. And just to hold this kind of just, what if I am none of those specific senses of me, but there's something much bigger, that those are just all relative realities. They have their purpose, their role, their detriments, their benefits, but there's something else that's there. And seeing that's to your son, you know, maybe that's his nature right now, is to be immersed in that video game. You know, and so just play with that a little bit, because it's really that's the koan, is that there's this friction with that. But ultimately it's seeing through that, to seeing that there is actually no difference.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Very helpful.
All right, Kathy, let's have you be the last question, and we have a few announcements.
Okay, thanks, Tim. It's been a wonderful talk, and I've enjoyed the comments a lot, too. I was, you're just coming around to something that I was wondering about, with the sunset being I think reflection is the word you use. And so when I'm looking at something painful or unpleasant or contemplating something I have to do, what's the analogy going to be? And in terms of the negative feelings, where does the self come into this? And I think you just answered it, actually, but I just want to be clear that I don't want to just tune out unpleasant things. I want to try to find out, you know, what's happening. Anything you could say about that?
Yes, it's, let's say it's an instance of seeing someone who's suffering. And just like with the beauty of like the sunset, there's a way we can just be completely undefended with it. We can allow it to just, you know, our hearts just come alive with that. And there's a joy, there's an openness. Now, with someone who's suffering, you know, there's that really taking in the fact of this, there's pain here, that there is sorrow, to feel that in some ways, that depth of that sadness in the moment. It's like, oh, wow, there's this. So there's that seeing both sides of life in an equal way. And so the trick is to not be swept away or lost in that, you know, to get in a way that you, because both with the beauty of nature, we can, you know, as Iris clearly articulated, we can become identified like, oh, I want that. You can feel what that feels like. Same thing with feeling the sadness or the sorrow or the, you know, the someone suffering. It's like you can feel that. And there's a point where you start to contract around it. You start to contract that sense of self around it. And so you start to, you know, I think a very helpful thing is to start to notice that. Notice the change between being, oh, I'm just receiving this person's suffering. I'm just really there for it. And then there's like, oh, I'm not quite comfortable, or I have to do something with it, or I need to fix it. That how that forms. It's like, oh, is that interesting? You know, who is perceiving? What is perceiving? What is experiencing this?
Thank you so much. That's great.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kathy. Yeah, thank you all for your questions. You can, you know, really see as each person asks a question, it's, you know, it not only helps them to deepen and explore and articulate their own wisdom and understanding, but also helps, you know, us kind of as a group understand it. So it's really, it's a gift of generosity for all of us. So thank you all for answering those questions.